Welcome to the Fremantle Press Podcast. My name is Rebecca Hickey, and today I'm talking to HM Waugh, Heather, about her middle grade fantasy novel, The Lost Stone of Sky City. We'll be talking to Heather about all things magic, prophecies, and, well, goats. We'll also be joined by a special guest and industry expert, Jane Fraser, CEO of Fremantle Press, for her top tips on foreign rights sales, what they are, and how you get one. Make sure you stay tuned as we put Heather through a pop quiz on a secret subject close to her heart, and settle in as we feature a special reading from her brand new book. Don't forget, if you like today's podcast, you can subscribe through iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, or where you get your favourite podcasts. Heather is a scientist, writer, and educator with a long-term love of wild places and high mountains. When she's not writing, she's teaching school and community groups about science and the environment. Heather, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
All right. Heather, so let's start with your book. What is The Lost Stone of Sky City about?
The Lost Stone of Sky City is a fantasy adventure where a girl and her goats go on a quest across the high mountains. It's got magic and it's got avalanches and it's got intrigue and humour and friendship and goats.
As you've
already figured out.
Absolutely. I'm always fascinated by how fantasy writers craft their magical worlds. What inspired you to create the world of the ice people, the dirt people, all their magic and all their goats?
The actual, like the physical world is based on places I've been travelling.
Awesome.
So I've got the Nepalese Himalayas, I've got the Swiss Alps, I've got spots in the Bolivian Altiplano in the Andes and places from the mountains in New Zealand. So I just kind of grabbed some of the most amazing viewpoints and places I can remember being, and I melded them all together to create the lands of the dirt and the ice.
Mm.
And in terms of their magic, I've just always really, like, I might like mountains, but I'm no good at reading them. And so I always thought, well, how awesome it would be if you were actually able to really read, you know, the mountains and the snows, and to see, you know, what was going to happen, where the dangers were. And so that's where the magic began.
Yeah, that's actually was one of the things I really, really loved about the book, where Sanea, our main character, is always reading the mountains, sensing what's about to happen, where if you put one foot here, it's dangerous, but one foot here is fine. It kind of made me feel like, she was really in tune with the natural world. I wonder, how has being an environmental scientist influenced your writing?
I thought it hadn't. Mm-hmm. And then people were reading my book and everyone was asking me that. And I had to think about it, and I realised that no matter where I go, I am being an environmental scientist. So if I'm going for a walk in the bush, I'm not just going, this is a nice walk in the bush. I'm thinking, what plants are here? Are they natural? Are they invasive weeds? You know, are they in balance? Are there any animals I can see or hear? You know, is the path causing erosion issues? These are all things that I'm just doing naturally.
Mm.
And that's not so much because I'm an environmental scientist, but I think I'm an environmental scientist because I loved doing that sort of thing, and it just extended it. So I presume I must have put that way of looking at the world into the book without even realising it.
Wow. I've actually got a friend who's an environmental scientist, and she does the exact same thing. Whenever I'm out with my son, I'll point to something and go, yeah, that's a bird. And she'll be like, she'll tell me exactly what it is, or she'll point out weeds and things like that. It's. I guess it's almost like Sanea in a way. You are reading the environment. Mm. Yeah, that's really cool. As well as the natural world, there's an ongoing theme in your book about destiny, particularly this trope of the chosen one.
Mm-hmm.
Yet you really do turn it on its head. Can you tell our listeners a bit more about how you played with this common trope and the idea of fate?
Mm-hmm. Well, the chosen one trope, I really love it. Like, I love books that have it, you know, where the ordinary person, something magical has happened, there's a prophecy and suddenly they're on this greater path and you know, heading towards this finale that they can't get out of, sort of thing. Mm. So I do love the chosen one trope, but I also think, and this is what I was thinking before I started the book, was there are a lot of kids these days that feel like they have only one path in life, you know, however they've been set up, you know, whatever schooling they've had, there's only one way they can go. And I wanted to sort of turn that chosen one trope on its head to say, well, you can make your own choices and you can make your own life. So hopefully kids reading the book won't know who's the chosen one? Is anyone the chosen one?
Yeah,
or are the characters just making their own choices? And that last bit, I think, is quite empowering.
Yeah,
that your choices can change your future.
Yeah, absolutely. There's also, at least when I read it, there's a kind of an ongoing tension where Saneya noticed that the ice people kind of live in luxury while her people, the dirt people, don't. She later realises, though, that the ice people are really sick and hungry. The things they eat, she's like, oh, this is horrible. Why are you giving me this? But it's actually the best that they've got that they're giving her. She says, so these ice people have palaces of greenstone and gold and baths throughout the winter, but we of the dirt have food and health. What are you trying to explore with this contrast here?
Well, obviously, on the surface, it's that thing that money isn't everything. You know, you can be very rich and still be unhealthy, be spending too much time at work, not enough time with your family, that sort of thing. And there are things that you can have even when you may not have all the money in the world that can make you very healthy and very happy. So for myself, I've got a backyard veggie patch, and I think that is more luxury than any greenstone palaces, because I can walk out and pick fresh peas and fresh beans and you know, beetroot and things like that. And so, yeah, to me, that's a luxury that doesn't take much and much money, but it's giving you this health and this happiness.
Yeah. Absolutely, the idea of you get happiness from something, and I feel like Saneya is not getting happiness from these luxurious places. She gets them, you know, from her home. Now, now is the point where I would love to talk to you about how you wrote the book, but I'm going to spring my pop quiz on you.
Oh, totally ready.
Totally ready.
Yep.
Awesome. So there is a very charming species of animals in your book called goatles, which I found very charming. they feature very prominently in your book, and I believe they were inspired by your love of goats. So this is your chance to share your knowledge of goats with us. All you have to do is answer true or false on whether the following are real breeds of goat.
Right.
So are you ready?
As ready as I possibly could be, I think.
Excellent. Okay. So let's see how well you know goats. So, true or false, a fainting goat?
True.
True. You are spot on. Apparently, it's a domestic goat that faints when it panics, which doesn't sound a very good kind of protective mechanism, does it? Okay, a giddy goat.
I'm going to say false.
Yeah, you're spot on. Yeah. It's an idiom from the Macquarie Dictionary meaning to behave in a foolish or frivolous manner.
Which is just harsh on goats, I think.
Well, I thought so too. Yeah, I thought you'd agree with me there. Okay, what about a pygmy goat?
Yes, true.
Yep, absolutely. A miniature goat. It's also known as a miniature goat, hardy or adaptable. What about a Nigerian dwarf goat?
Yeah, true. I think they're one of the smallest, aren't they?
Well, apparently they're extremely friendly and you can train them to walk on a leash.
Yeah, totally.
That's so cool. I want to see them around suburbia now.
I want
when I'm
one.
Going for a walk.
Yeah. That's why I know about them.
Awesome. What about a lonely goat?
That can't be a breed. You're having me on there, false.
I am having you on. That's taken from the Sound of Music puppet show. What about a Dillamond goat?
I think you're just making up words like goatle there. I'm going to say false.
You're right.
Yes.
Dr. Dillamond is a talking goat and professor in the book Wicked by Gregory Maguire. But a kinder goat.
Yeah, I'm going to say true, and I've always thought they were a kinder goat.
Oh, maybe. See, there you go. See, you know more about the quiz than I do. it's a cross between a pygmy goat and a Nubian goat, apparently. So a Russian white goat.
It's not very explanatory. I'm going to say true, though.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
It's a dairy goat, or what you get when you cross a Swiss goat with a Russian goat. So a booted goat.
Booted goat. I have never seen a goat in boots. False.
Apparently it's true.
She fails.
the only one so far. It's a breed of domestic mountain goat from Sweden.
And does it have boots?
I hope so.
I want one.
Yes.
I want to see a photo. I'm going to have to Google it.
So we've only got two more to go. Coffee stain goat.
That just sounds like you made that up. False.
Yep, you're right.
Yes.
It's but we've drawn that from Coffee Stain Studios developed a third person goat simulator game where each player controls a goat.
That would be awesome.
Yeah.
You could climb up all the cliff faces and things. Oh, I'd like to do that.
Awesome. Our last one, escape goat.
Now, that is actually like a legitimate historical reference to the person. The goat, they used to sacrifice one goat and they used to let one goat free.
Oh, wow.
And that's where scapegoat came from. And it was like a sacrifice to the gods or something. So that's totally true, but it's not a breeder goat. It's a thing.
Yeah, that's awesome. I just liked it because it was a pun.
Yeah, so, exactly. You know, but it's real.
Yeah, awesome.
This is how much I do my world building.
I was going to say, you really, I think you got 10 out of 11. So
not that I'm competitive, but yes.
Yes. So you really do know about goats then. So it's legit.
You should see my search history. Yeah. Oh,
awesome. You know, it's actually really awesome for me to see that you have this wealth of knowledge after reading the book and really feeling your love of the animals as well. So that's really fun. Thank you so much for letting me put you through the ringer there.
Oh, I'm so glad you chose goats. I didn't know what it was going to be.
Oh, good. So we'll soon be hearing from Jane Fraser about foreign rights sales. So when I read your bio in the back of the book, and you have referenced it before, you've travelled to exotic places, you have this exciting job where you work with kids and animals, and you can truthfully say you work with dragons. So you seem to have a pretty full-on life.
Mm-hmm.
How do you find the time to write? Can you tell us about your writing process?
When I first came back to writing, because I used to write a lot when I was a teenager, and then I thought once one was an adult, one stopped writing things. And also I think because I thought I was supposed to be reading adult books, which I just found completely boring. So once I decided to come back to writing, it was actually like October the 30th, and I thought somewhere I'd heard on the news about NaNoWriMo, the National Novel Writing Month, that was starting like in 2 days' time.
The next day, yeah.
And it was 50,000 words in a whole month. And I thought, well, I could sit around and watch telly once my child's asleep, because she was only young then, or I could try my hand at doing this. And so I just jumped right in and did a NaNoWriMo. And that is basically how I write from now on, is I write sort of as a NaNoWriMo. I make up my own one. So I make up a JanoWriMo if I do it in January, or a FeboWriMo, which is a hard one because you've got fewer days to write.
Yeah.
So I will write first drafts very quickly. And up until sort of the last couple of years, I used to write at night as well. So once my daughter was in bed, I would stay up and write as long as I could. And then go to sleep. And that's obviously very wearying.
I was going to say, how do you do that?
I'd only do it for a month, and then I'd absolutely sort of collapse and have to sleep and read books and just relax my brain. But for that month, I wouldn't even read back on my draft. You just get to there and you read the previous sentence and you just write and you keep on going. So you don't miss your voice. You don't lose it. Don't read anything else. Don't do anything else. Just write for that month.
Yeah, that's a good tip. I always like to think of to turn off my inner critic, I'd always just be like, okay, I'm just going to vomit out all this stuff, you know, get out all the clay. I can sculpt it later, you know. I do wonder, so you would have a month like a NaNoWriMo. You'd just do a month. Then what kind of break would you have? Would you give yourself a few months before you return to it, or would you just slowly start your editing? How would you do that?
I always prescribe by leaving the book for as long as you can, so that you come back and it's like you're reading a new, like somebody else is writing, and you go, oh, did I put that in? That's really awesome. So The Lost Stone of Sky City, I did, I think, in 2016, NaNoWriMo. So I wrote it in a month, and then I forgot about it. I went back to uni the next year. I actually forgot I'd written it, and I picked it up sort of a year and a half later, because I had to have something to put forward to a conference I was going to. So that was a very long break for it before I started editing.
Did it take you a month to write The Lost Stone of Sky City?
Yes. Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
And there's very few changes from what I wrote, yeah.
Wow. So
I don't edit much.
It took me 12 years to write my book, so I'm extremely impressed.
But I think everybody's journey is different and however it works, you know?
Yeah, that's...
If you're writing and it's making you happy, then keep on doing it the way you're doing it. That's what I always say.
Yeah, absolutely. And despite only doing it in a month, it is quite a detailed, immersive world that you've created. Mm-hmm. So do you have any advice for emerging writers on world building?
Mm-hmm. I do. And when I say like I wrote it in a month, I didn't do the world building in that month.
Sure.
I usually will get a separate document and I will research a lot about about a world before I even start writing the book. So there's a lot of preparation. And most of that won't go into the book, but I think you get that feeling that it's in there if you do enough world building.
Absolutely.
And I always like to think of, you know, what makes a culture, what makes a society. People play sports, they play games, they pass down stories, they eat food, they play music. You know, what are all these things? So I try to get all those little things and weave them in as well. And a great tip that I got from somewhere is to steal from history. And I love that.
I love that
so,
too.
Yeah. You know, go back, find out what sort of houses they lived in whatever time and you know, pull that in because you get these really authentic characteristics to your world if you can bring in historical things. And I also love to bring in science as well because I think there's nothing weirder than fact. And so you can tie in these strange things from history and opportunities from the future and make a world.
Awesome. It's good to, like for me to hear that you do a lot of prep. I'm curious, how long does that process take? What does that involve? Do you do research or do you just kind of have a bit of a think and then jot things down? How does your prep work before you actually start that crazy month of writing?
I have to, I still haven't signed on to Nano this year because I still haven't got the idea of what I'm going to do. But yeah, I have ideas will come up and I've got a little diary that I'll just write the idea down in. And then every now and then I'll pick up the diary and I'll read through and I think, well, look, one idea on its own isn't going to make it. But if I add that idea to that idea and, you know, push this third idea into it as well, maybe there's a story in there. And so I wait until it sort of coalesces into my brain that there is a potential story. Mm. And then I start to write down as much as I can think about the story, you know, what's the sort of summary of what might happen. And then, yeah, I start to Google everything. Mm. And find all these interesting things that help me to think about what might happen. I don't plan the story so much. I know the major like things that will happen
in the plot. Yeah,
but I also let the story change as I write because I think the characters, as you know them, you start to they might different decisions to what you might have thought they made if you were planning beforehand.
Yeah, cool. But, you also mentioned that you would write at night when. Your daughter went to bed. I've got a very little boy who's only 10 months now, and I cannot imagine how I could possibly write at the moment. What? And I've learned that there are, especially a lot of mothers who write but struggle to find time. So what advice would you have for, you know, parents who are perhaps want to write but are really struggling? Mm. Like what advice for fitting in that time would you...
I think, I didn't start writing again until my daughter was sort of 2.5, almost getting to 3. So, I had that time when she was a bub. I was just there
full-time,
for her.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be, and I'm glad I wasn't thinking, oh, I've got this other thing to do. I was very lucky in terms of that because I was made redundant from my job. So I just had nothing to head back to. So I was able to just focus on her. And you can't get that time back either. So I'm very glad. But I am totally in awe when I read of parents who continue to write and have due dates and, you know, drafts and things to write when they've got these little bubbies. I don't know how they do it. I really don't. I'm so impressed by them. But for me, I just did what I could. And when I'm writing as well, I'm also a happier mother if I'm writing and it's going well. So I think that me having this thing and this outlet that helps me to be happy also helps me be a better mum. Mm. So, yeah, that I'm certainly not for perfect mums and not for, you know, guilt-tripping people.
No, definitely not.
However things work. But, I couldn't do it permanently, but certainly in those months when I was writing, I'd be on this high because this thing was happening. I was making this world and this story.
Yeah. And it's good for me to hear that you know, probably didn't get back to it or didn't come to it until your bub was 3. Because I do also, I really love spending time with my son more than anything at the moment, working with Frio, doing these podcasts. It's kind of taking me out for a little while, but he constantly calls me back.
Yeah.
So, and I actually like that. It's almost like I'm forgetting that I have these other things to do because I'm so immersed in being with him. But I also hear what you're saying about you may become a happier mum or a happier parent if you're actually doing something that you really love. So,
yeah. And inspiring your kids as well to follow what they love too.
Yeah. I am quite excited about one day I can be like, oh, do you want to read what mummy wrote? You know,
who knows? You've got a bit of time.
I was going to say.
I thought mine might be your chance, you know, 7-year-old. Would you like to read? No, not yet.
I was going to say, or we might get the... Mum, no.
You're
like, I'm not interested
book.
In your book. Yeah. Cool. You know, I'm also, I also find I don't have time to read. I've been listening to a lot of audiobooks and to try and still read. But I am fascinated by what writers read because I think it tells you something about the writer. I'd love to know what is sitting on your bedside table at the moment and what made you pick it?
Oh, God. I'm just going to ignore the what's sitting on your bedside table because that's not for the...
Not for the podcast.
No, that's not for the podcast. There's so many things on my bedside table. Yep. Probably need to clean.
Yep.
What am I reading at the moment? I have just actually finished reading Toffel Towers Fully Booked, which is written by Tim Harris and illustrated by the amazing James Foley, who's also a West Australian author, illustrator. And I bought it for my nephew and I thought, well, I better just double check that it's appropriate.
Mm.
So I started reading it with my daughter and then we laughed so much. We had to go for several toilet breaks, you know, emergency toilet breaks for excess laughing. And I'm not going to say who required the toilet breaks each time because that's just, no one needs to know that. But yeah, it was so funny that I had to finish it that night without her. Mm. And now she's rereading it again because we had to get our own copy.
Oh, wow.
So funny. So funny.
Oh, that's so, well, that's a pretty big endorsement that it's something that adults and children alike can enjoy.
Yeah, I love kids' books. I mean, that's...
Mm. I've actually heard other, especially young adult writers saying, yeah, I love kids' books and I feel like, I can't remember who it was, but someone said they felt guilty that they enjoyed YA or kids' books so much. I think, yeah, that's something we need to get out of. Do you think that there are more adults now that read YA books or children's books, or is it something that's still a little bit taboo?
I don't know because I wasn't in the scene when I was a, you know, an adult that was trying to read adult books. But I certainly know for myself that I'd read them and some of them was just dark and kind of depressing and boring. And you know, I never really got caught up in a book except for when those big YA books like The Hunger Games and things like that would come through onto the adult scene.
Mm.
And so I just felt it so, it was an amazing thing to realise that I could read these books. Why not?
Mm.
And to read them with the hat on thinking, well, can I also write something like this? You know, so you can read a book that maybe it's at a level that's too low for you to really enjoy, but your writer brain is on. And so you're going, I love how they've put that in and, oh, this works really well. And then you can also read ones just like this Toffel Towers that I'm laughing at
just
some jokes
fun,
that my daughter's not getting and she's giggling away at everything else. That is just purely for fun and it makes me happy to read kids' books. I think they've always, no matter what, they've always got some pulse of hope through them and I really love that.
Yeah, that's wonderful. We will be returning to your book soon. I know we've been talking about a lot of other writers now, but first I'd like us to come to the segment we're calling Phone a Friend. It's a chance for our listeners to learn some behind-the-scenes info about publishing from experienced authors and industry professionals. Today's theme is foreign rights, which I know nothing about. Heather, do you know anything about foreign rights?
If you'd done my pop quiz on foreign rights, I would have not done
We would not have had 10 out of 11.
No.
Okay, cool. Well, so let's turn to someone who does know quite a lot about it. Our guest today is the CEO of Fremantle Press, Jane Fraser. So let's give her a call and find out what publishers do to secure foreign right deals for authors.
Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, Jane. Welcome to the Fremantle Press podcast. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Great to be here.
Now, I would love to know what do publishers do to secure foreign right deals for authors? Take it away.
Well, it all begins with the contract, and the author contracts that we have in place are pretty much standard. Most publishers have them, whereby there is a whole bunch of subsidiary rights in the contract that deal with things like film, stage, international rights, which include foreign rights, adaptations, and all sorts of things. And they all come under one particular clause. And so when authors have a look at that, they can see that in essence, it means that the author's contract and the author licenses the publisher to then deal as an agent would in securing sales for those books, either with foreign publishers or stage rights or film rights. So basically it's an exclusive license that we would then give to overseas publishers so that they could publish the book under their own imprint, mm-hmm. and or in their own language. And then the contract with that publisher would specify a fixed term, the advance rate, the royalty rates and so on.
So does that is that something you normally you get approached for, or do you actually go out and approach other publishers?
It's a very active space for publishers, and it's a really important one, and it's worldwide. So there's a lot of buying and selling of rights that goes on all the time. There are specific conferences and events and fairs that publishers and agents can attend where international rights are sold, and they're the Frankfurt Book Fair, and that's usually in October, and it's massive. You know, wow. Frankfurt is the big convention centre of the world, and there are hundreds and hundreds and probably thousands of publishers who buy and sell rights from each other all around the world in all sorts of languages. The other book fairs, the big book fairs, are held in Bologna every year, and that's a children's specific book fair. Wow. And that's usually in the beginning of the year around March, April. And then there's also some new book fairs in Beijing and Shanghai, which have developed. Beijing's a very big consumer of books, and rights are bought and sold in all languages at those book fairs, not just Chinese sales to foreign publishers, but everybody goes to essentially sell with each other, but also to sell to the new, you know, burgeoning new publishing market in China. And then, of course, there's the US book fair in New York. It's called Book Expo, and that's usually at the end of May, early June every year. So there's a lot of activity. And then there are lots of different smaller, you know, fairs that go on around the world, in Mexico and South America and so on. But those are the big ones for the internationals.
So are you constantly travelling to book fairs then?
I wish. No, we don't. We don't have the budget to travel. So what we've got in place, which works incredibly well, and we've had it for many, many years, is a cohort of about 20 or 30 agents who are foreign language agents who sell, buy and sell on our behalf. So they will go out into their territories. Say, for example, in China, we have an agency there in China who know their market very well, who know their publishers, and then they also know our books. So I'm constantly in touch with them, updating them with what new books are coming out, and then they will go, look, I think I can find a publisher for that because that's the kind of book that they would want. Similarly, we have agents in Spain, in Italy, France, Germany, Korea, Turkey, and we're developing a few in the United States. So it's really active, and it's a lot of fun because these agents are really part of the Fremantle Press family in a way. We get to know them very well. We don't necessarily meet them, but we're always talking to them throughout the year, not just at book fair time.
Wow. And how do you pick books, I'm curious, that maybe you would want to put into different markets, or is that maybe the job of the agents?
It's you get to learn a lot about what the market's buying and selling, and I'm particularly interested in obviously in what they will buy from us. Mm. And you get to know, oh, this particular book would do really well in Korea, or this book would do really well in Germany. For example, the Germans love crime, so our adult crime books tend to be picked up in Germany, but nowhere else. Wow. China, Korea love the children's books, so they are very interested in our new picture books that come out. And in fact, it's the children's books that are selling probably the most successfully around the world for us, and that's probably not. Not surprising, because children's books are universal in a way. Those children's stories are universal, And the book, the global children's book market is growing at about a rate of about 20%.
Wow.
Every year. So it's, you know, it's lucky for us, we get new babies every year that want to read books when they're a little bit older. So you also get to know what kind of books agents are interested in or publishers are interested in by talking to the agents, and then their reports come through saying, look, Australia, you know, Outback Australia is hot to trot. So if you've got any Outback crime novels or Outback fiction, or we want some rural romance, or we want some women's fiction or that sort of thing. And you tend to sort of keep abreast of the trends and then feed through the books that might be successful. But, you know, Rebecca, having said that, there are always some surprises.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And it's always very personal, and the publishers out there are curating their own lists. So some of them really want something specific, or they and they might fall in love with a book of ours, which we just think is terrific. So you can't close the door on anything.
Yeah, I always assumed that if a book got foreign rights, then maybe it was like a bestseller or something. But it sounds like it's more about trends in different markets.
It is, and everybody wants something new and exciting. Having said that, though, the bestsellers are always the ones that they want to pick because it's safe publishing.
Yeah.
But for us as a publisher of new writers, I get a lot of interest in our new books, and people aren't necessarily wanting to know that it's a bestseller. They just want to know that it's new and fresh and interesting. And so there's this new cohort of agents out there who are called literary scouts, who go around the world on behalf of publishers and try and find something that's the new bestseller next year, which is impossible to determine, but that's what they're after.
Wow. I'd love to know how they actually pick that.
That'd be balls, I think.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your insights, Jane.
You're welcome.
That was amazing. There's so much I didn't know about foreign rights. That was great.
Yeah. Fingers crossed that The Lost Stone of Sky City will see itself over the seas.
Well, it's already got to my nano buddy in America, so she's got one copy, so I'm already foreign right, not really.
Not quite, almost.
I thought I was until I listened to Jane, and now I...
Excellent. Okay, now we're coming to the end of our podcast, and Heather, I'm hoping you'll read an excerpt from your book. But before you do, I have one last question. One thing that kept coming up in your book was this idea of home. Sanaya kept wanting to be home despite her horrible father, this lack of comfort or luxury, and despite the possibility that she was going to get married off. There is something about home that makes it special. What do you believe makes a home home, not just for Sanaya, but for all of us?
It's an interesting question, because Sanaya doesn't always just want to go home because it's home. It's also, I think, and I get this a lot, she's outside of her comfort zone for a lot of this. Mm. And so she kind of wants to get back into that place that she remembers, and she knows how she works and how everything else works. Mm. And so that's a lot of why she sort of wants to go back. And also she's got this responsibility to get these Gotals back to her father. But, yes, there are also some wonderful things in her home, like her greatest aunt and things like that, people that she loves and food that she loves.
Mm.
I think, you know, what makes a home is what you put into it. So have you got people there or that make you happy? Have you got a comfortable spot where you can sit and read a book? You know, have you got, you can make a home anywhere.
Yeah.
It's all in your mental ability. And so Sanaya, she wants to not be stuck in what she's stuck in quite often.
Mm.
And that's why she dreams of her home. But she's also, by the end of it, I'd hope she's come through like I often do and realize that even though she pushed through that uncomfortable stage, she's now comfortable in this new world as well.
Mm. And I think that's a nice thing to think about, that you can, if you are going through something, maybe you've had to move somewhere for whatever reason, you can make a home wherever you are.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's about how you make it. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's actually have a reading from The Lost Stone of Sky City. What are you reading today? What part are we reading?
I'm going to read one of my favourite parts, because it's like a turning part for the book. It starts on page 36 at the break, and it's where Sanaya and her nephew and friend Danim are both sleeping in the hut and the ice people come. Spoilers.
Wonderful. Take it away.
And I wake with a start, like a scorpion is crawling over my head. What woke me? I've no idea what time it is, day or night. It's hard enough remembering where I am. I hold my breath and listen. My ears register nothing of concern. Danim breathes steadily next to me. I check his neck and it's comfortably warm. Gotal fills my nostrils, soft snuffling breaths. They're all asleep too. Outside, the snow is largely silent, but the air hums a song of early morning, of the sky that lightens and the mountains that catch the first colours of dawn. What woke me? My stomach growls. I sigh. I'm letting this isolation, this weird snow carpet land, get to me. I try to relax, sternly telling my stomach to settle down. No need to wake the rest of the room because I'm hungry. The air outside feels happy and I smile. I never hear or feel like this in the village. I can't actually remember feeling this clearly before. I suppose it's how high up in the mountains we are, how deep in winter it still is up here. It lends clarity to a place that is buzzing and busy in summer. Boom! The noise resounds through the hut. Danim shoots upright. What's that? Boom! My heart hammers. The gotals bleat. This isn't happening. Something isn't bashing on the hut door. Boom! It must be Uncle, Danim says. But I know it isn't Uncle. Ignoring the fact he's dead. Uncle I can feel. Uncle I can recognise. Whatever's out there is invisible to my heightened mountain senses. Whatever's out there I don't know, have never met, don't comprehend. In my head, I'm hearing Mira's voice again, telling me the tale of how vengeful King Uren of the Ice People turned trespassers into ice sculptures destined to melt in the thaw. I grab Danim's arm. Don't go out there. We must help him. It's not him. The knocking is replaced by the dreadful screech of the main door opening. Someone is entering the main room. Or something. The gotals are up and milling around excitedly. Light shines beneath the door to our room. Bright light that wavers. I search for my knife, tucked in my right boot. Where did I put it last night? By the dragon, Danim says. What's happening? My grateful hands close on the icy hilt of my knife at the exact moment our door shutters open. And there is only light. Light like a summer noon. I shut my eyes, but the light remains. Fear freezes me like ice. And then, of course, we've got to jump to chapter 5 because no one can turn the light out at that point. Chapter 5. Take your hand off the knife, dirt girl. The voice is powerful, despite sounding as young as Danim. I shrink back, but I don't drop the knife. I'm not stupid. What do you want? Get out of our hut. The owner of the voice chuckles, but without warmth. Have you lost track of time, dirt girl? The winter has not yet waned, and therefore you are in our hut. He sniffs, though I hate to claim something so dismal. And smelly. No wonder we never come here. Our hut? Dirt girl? My mind is a foggy whirl and I can't think straight. But could this boy be? Da, 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 da. You'll have to read on to figure out.
Well, if you want to read on, you can get The Lost Stone of Sky City from fremantlepress.com.au in all good bookstores or maybe up the side of a mountain if you go hunting. Heather, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been fun.
Yeah, it was lots of fun. So if you enjoyed today's chat, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. My name's Rebecca Higgy, and I've been your host today. As the winner of the 2019 Fogarty Literary Award, I'll be running this show until my book, The History of Mischief, is released in September 2020. Join me next time for more insights into the world of books, publishing, magic, and more.